say is that what I'm going to talk about with regard to Nietzsche is intended to fall under a historical heading. That is, I want to address the question of what Nietzsche himself meant by talking of eternal recurrence. And as many of you will know, stacks have been written on this, and what I'm about to say, what I'm going to propose, is certainly contestable, not because it's especially eccentric or original, but just because there is no majority view, there's no real dominant consensus concerning how to interpret this or any other bit of Nietzsche. Also want to say that the historical issue that I'm addressing, what Nietzsche meant, is distinct, of course, from the question of what use we might make of his idea when we bring it into connection with psychoanalysis or another context. And I accept that innovative reconstructions, rereadings, are arguably more, at the end of the day, more purposive than merely historical inquiries. All the same, I think it's a good idea to start by establishing a historical perspective so that we can recognize, as far as it's possible, when we're imputing something to Nietzsche that goes beyond the warrants defined by his own texts, or bending him to some purpose of ours that he didn't share, rather than simply re-expositing his ideas. And this need for a historical basis is, I think, especially great in the present case. Nietzsche and Freud are in some ways so extraordinarily close, there's a natural tendency to run them together. You see Freud as running directly on from Nietzsche, as if they composed a single tradition or line of thought in the history of ideas, centered on, I suppose, the concepts of the unconscious drive, unconscious determination, and Massive that's written displays this outlook. Well, my own view, which will emerge in what I'm going to say, is that really the Nietzsche-Freud relation needs to be handled with great care. And there are very, very deep differences between their respective projects or theoretical discourses. So that's all of that, just preliminary. So to begin with the relevant passage, at least I think part of this was quoted on the original the website program. This is from Gay Science, section 341. I say the relevant passage, but as you'll know, there are several places in Nietzsche's works where he exposits or says something important about eternal recurrence. In fact, by my count, if you include unpublished notebooks, there are probably about 24 major passages. In any case, this is the one to focus on. So I'll read it through. The greatest weight. What if some day or night a demon were to steal after you into your loneliness and say to you, this life as you now live it and have lived it, you will have to live once more and innumerable times more. There will be nothing new in it, but every pain, every joy, every thought and sigh, everything unutterably small or great in your life will have to return to you, all in the same succession and sequence. Even this spider and this moonlight between the trees, even this moment, I myself. The eternal hourglass of existence is turned upside down again and again, and you with it, speck of dust. Would you not throw yourself down and gnash your teeth and curse the demon who spoke thus? Or have you once experienced a tremendous moment when you would have answered him, you are a god, never have I heard anything more divine. If this thought gained possession of you, it would change you as you are, or perhaps crush you. The question in each and everything, do you desire this once more and innumerable times more, would lie upon your actions as the greatest weight. Or how well disposed would you have to become to yourself and to life to crave nothing more fervently than this ultimate eternal confirmation and seal. So here, the idea of eternal recurrence is presented from two angles. First, in what we might call diagnostic terms, and then in therapeutic terms. So first, it is a kind of ideational device that tests our capacity for entertaining a certain attitude death student question is amor fati, or love of fate, which Nietzsche talks about earlier, declares to be his aim earlier in the same book, Gay Science. He says his aim now is, and I quote, to learn more and more how to see what is necessary in things as what is beautiful in them. So that's the new ideal. So eternal recurrence, the idea, first tests for our capacity, and then secondly, Nietzsche thinks it has the potential to, in some way, engender it, not immediately, of course, but in the way that ideals generally regulate our efforts and motivate us to achieve certain ends, they allow us to measure our distance from them, and so on. And this second therapeutic aspect presupposes the first. So we begin by registering the negative, oppressive force of the idea. We experience it, first of all, as the greatest weight. And then we are to aim to convert it into positive desirability. Now, putting it like this sounds very instrumental, as if the device could be discarded after it's done its work. And then secondly, as if Nietzsche were not claiming any truth for it. So let me say something very briefly about these two points. Well, I think Nietzsche is not in fact committed to the strict necessity of the idea as an instrument. He thinks there could be, perhaps there once were, human beings who have no need of it, and perhaps we, having used it, might cease to have need of it. However, as things stand in our intellectual historical locality, Nietzsche thinks it's a front runner, it's without competition. And to that extent, it has at least a kind of local necessity in that sustaining the love of fate will require us, Nietzsche thinks, to hold eternal recurrence in mind as an image. What does count, I think, I grant a bit more strongly against the sort of therapeutic reading, is the fact that there are certain places, other places, where Nietzsche does present eternal recurrence in a different way, something more like a doctrine, a cosmological or physical or metaphysical thesis, as if it were not merely a thought that we might confront ourselves with, as in, what if, nor a fiction that we might, as it were, work under, let me live or proceed as if, but rather as if it were something that we might believe to be the case, and for which, furthermore, certain passages suggest an argument can be given. So there are passages in the Zarathustra book and in the late notebooks when Nietzsche does seem to think that hypotheses can be given a proof using a rather heady mixture of physics and a priori metaphysics. So here is just one very brief and succinct instance from the late notebooks, where Nietzsche seems to think that there could be a proof of physics, proof from physics of the idea. And it's also relevant to say that there are various other ideas in Nietzsche, famously the idea of will to power, perhaps also speculativism, which do seem intended, or many commentators take them to be intended, as doctrines, positive philosophical theses. So one might think that eternal recurrence is another component in Nietzsche's philosophical system. Well, I'll come back to this, but a quick observation on this point or this challenge is that passages in which eternal recurrence is presented dogmatically, meaning as if it were true, are, I think, only, certainly chiefly, if not only, in the Zarathustra book. And Nietzsche says of Zarathustra that he preaches nothing, teaches no faith. There's nothing that he tells us which requires belief. And secondly, they appear, as in this instance, in the unpublished Nachlass, where people argue about this, but in my view, Nietzsche can't be assumed, or safely assumed, to be doing anything more than trying out ideas, experimenting with them, as we all do in our unpublished writings. And just to underline this point, there is another place in the late notebooks from about a year earlier, I think, which should make us very wary of taking Tamil recurrence at face value. So to hear Nietzsche says, to imprint upon becoming the character of being, that is the highest will to power. And it is a dual falsification by the senses and by the mind in order to obtain all other things that are, remain, of equal value, etc. That everything recurs, so the doctrine of eternal recurrence, is the most extreme approximation of a world of becoming to one of being. It is the pinnacle of contemplation. And the world of being, Nietzsche has just said, is a dual falsification. Now, from what I've said, two questions are immediately raised. One is, so what then in general is, in Nietzsche's terms, required for an idea like eternal recurrence to function in a therapeutic way? How can it function therapeutically if it's not something that we are to believe to be true? And secondly, there is the narrower question of how exactly is the idea of eternal recurrence supposed to function? What is it about it that is supposed to induce or at least kind of bring us closer to life affirmation or love of fate? So I'll start with the second question, and I'll begin by ruling out certain possibilities that might suggest themselves. First, I think it's clear that the idea that our lives were produced eternally can't be simply a way of eternalizing our existence in the way that, to take an example known to Nietzsche, Spinoza thinks that we can achieve a kind of immortality simply through reason, the intuitive power of reason, without relying on any theistic intervention. Now, this can't be the significance of eternal recurrence because it tells us that we relive our finite lives infinitely many times, not that we remove ourselves from the finite temporal world. So eternal recurrence doesn't relieve us from the burden of mortality, rather it underscores our mortality by multiplying the occasion of our dying. We are mortal many times over. Second, the idea that our lives repeat eternally can't be, I think, simply a way of confronting us with the general idea of necessity, the idea that all that we do, everything we undergo, is determined. Now, Nietzsche certainly does think we lack free will, and he also believes in universal necessity. But he doesn't need the idea of eternal recurrence to convince us of either. He has ample passages showing those things. Nor, indeed, is it really clear that eternal recurrence implies determinism. After all, the idea that our life repeats eternally, although it puts us in mind of predestination, but strictly being told that we will each time make the same choice, or set of choices, doesn't mean that they aren't choices. And the relations between this instance of my life and later ones is not a causal relation. It's not like the relation between a sequence of billiard balls, one of which causes the other to move. In any case, sheer recognition of necessity hardly seems conducive to life affirmations. So the traditional association of necessitarianism or determinism is with Stoicism, and Stoicism is really is much too apathetic an ethic to be of interest for Nietzsche. A third point, Nietzsche is famously engaged in this revaluation or transvaluation of all values, but it seems that eternal recurrence can't selectively purge us of those life-negating attitudes that Nietzsche wants us to be rid of, so I think regret, guilt, ressentiment, and so on. If those attitudes are malign, then it's for reasons that have nothing to do with eternal recurrence, and eternal recurrence doesn't reinforce them. So the infinite repetition or awareness of the infinite repetition of a particular one's own life is not itself a reason why that life shouldn't contain self-negation, or even conclude with total life denial. So Schopenhauer, who is Nietzsche's arch opponent on this topic, would quite possibly accept the idea that the pursuit of life negation, unconditional life denial, is a task that needs to be completed infinitely many times. Again, it's hard to see how eternal recurrence might contribute to Nietzsche's stated aim that I referred to earlier of learning to see what is beautiful in things. If things have a hidden beauty, then eternal recurrence won't help us to see it, since repetition itself doesn't make things beautiful, and repetition of the very same, which is what the demon or God is telling us about, that is not selective. It doesn't select out the beautiful from the ugly. And in this way, eternal recurrence seems to contrast with Nietzsche's other famous aesthetic proposals in The Birth of Tragedy, other places where he talks of transfiguring the world through selective vision. Well, here is an interesting positive. I've been indicating difficulties in understanding how the notion of eternal recurrence is supposed to work. Here is a suggestion, comes from the very opening of Kundera's novel. So, read through it. The idea of eternal return is a mysterious one. Nietzsche has often perplexed other philosophers with it. To think that everything recurs as we once experienced it, and that the recurrence itself recurs ad infinitum. What does this mad myth signify? Putting it negatively, the myth of eternal return states that a life which disappears once and for all, which does not return, is like a shadow, without weight, dead in advance, whether it was horrible, beautiful, or sublime, its horror, sublimity, and beauty mean nothing. Let us therefore agree that the idea of eternal return implies a perspective from which things appear other than as we know them. They appear without the mitigating circumstance of their transitory nature. This mitigating circumstance prevents us from coming to a verdict. But how can we condemn something that is ephemeral in transit? In the sunset of dissolution, everything is illuminated by the aura of nostalgia, even the guillotine. And, in the passage that I admitted, he talks about how historians view Robespierre. So the force of eternal occurrence, Kundera is suggesting, lies in its ability to, its capacity to compensate for, the title of the novel, the unbearable lightness of being. Eternal recurrence lends weight, it induces seriousness, yet allows a value to be put on things which would otherwise be cancelled by their transience. And this, of course, coheres with the title of the original passage, The Greatest Weight. However, I think it's not right for two reasons, and I should say Kundera himself immediately goes on to query the suggestion that he's just put forward here. So one reason is that Nietzsche in general is, as it were, anti-weight. The most striking poetic images of exaltation and affirmation in his texts are characteristically light-infused. Images of motion, elevation, mountain tops, eagles, birds in flight, and so on. Zarathustra at one point says that his aim is to, quote, make boundary stones fly. In another part of the case, science, Nietzsche praises elevated moods, perpetual movement, a continual ascent as on stairs, and at the same time, a sense of resting on the clouds. So, it seems that if eternal recurrence adds weight, then its therapeutic mechanism must be simply and exclusively homeopathic. And that certainly does not fit the text. The second reason for declining Kundera's suggestion, and this is a reason that Kundera himself gives later, is that the very same effect of making things matter, or making everything matter absolutely, can stem just as forcibly, or at least certainly before, from a recognition of their transience. This is perhaps the real meaning of the final conclusion of Condorcet's novel. So, here are, and I won't read them out because they're too beautiful to be read out by anything but an angel. lines from Rilke's ninth elegy. Rilke, of course, acquainted with Nietzsche. The force of which is to say once, once only, once is enough. So, having said everything that I've said, time to note that a number of commentators have concluded that the idea of eternal recurrence really dissolves on examination and collapses into incoherence. One commentator points out that if we consider eternal recurrence in what in the old days people used to call verificationist terms, then the idea just seems simply devoid of significance. And the point is, point here is, it's not just that we have no means of knowing that it's true, nor that the impossibility of verification makes it strictly nonsensical. The point is just that even if it were true, it fails to impinge on us. So, if I were told that there are an infinite number of lecterns simultaneously present in this lectern, it wouldn't make any difference to the way that I perceive it or think about it. I wouldn't come to see infinity flickering in it. So in the same way, so the argument goes, eternal recurrence doesn't allow me to experience an infinity in my own life. It leaves me trapped in my finitude. And in this regard, I think worth noting that eternal recurrence contrasts with all of the other high-profile notions in Nietzsche, all of the ideas about aesthetic justification, will to power, revaluation of values, self-creation, perspectivism, all of that stuff, chapter headings in every commentary on Nietzsche. Well, all of these are tethered to experience. They have some kind of phenomenological resonance. Eternal recurrence is, I think, the only instance in Nietzsche of a strictly transcendent metaphysical hypothesis, one that makes no difference to experience. And yet, this is the puzzle, as we know, the whole point of it is to somehow alter us from the inside. Well, many philosophical ideas exhibit this peculiar property that when we try to look at them directly, squarely in the face, they just dissipate, vanish from sight. The special peculiarity of eternal recurrence is that it seems, as it were, designed to do this, as if that were the whole point of it. And this brings me to my own suggestion about how the idea is meant to work. The first of the idea, it seems to me, lies first in what it strips away, what it eliminates. Then, secondly, in the way that it refashions or employs what we're left with, which is very little, in order to superimpose two pictures on one another, two pictures which are incongruous. And the result is incoherent, but it's incoherence of a calculated and purposive kind. So, what eternal recurrence strips away is, of course, otherworldliness. We listen to the demon or the god who informs us of our eternal recurrence. We listen with our natural orientation to the future, in our ordinary practical existence. We're always, of course, looking ahead with hope and anticipation to the day of judgment or the day when we'll be happy. And what eternal recurrence does is to project this future forward indefinitely. And this puts us in a position of looking forward into a tunnel which extends forever and which, crucially, this is a point Nietzsche underlines in various places, has no outside. So the first of the idea is to circumscribe us and to draw a boundary around our vision. So our life becomes all that there is and all that there could be. And any notion that we have of another world just becomes the notion of this world all over again. And Nietzsche, this idea of a tunnel kind of hanging in nothingness or darkness, this is reflected in the way that Nietzsche constantly associates talk of eternal recurrence with abyss, with the abysmal. So the doctrine in Bergkamp's eternal recurrence is described as Zarathustra's abysmal thought. So that's the negative work that it does. Well, what do we get in return? Well, it offers, this is an ironical matter in a way, it offers us what we most want, but in the exact opposite form from that in which we've come to conceive it, thanks to Plato, Kant, Schopenhauer, church fathers, Judaic, ascetic priests, and so on. So instead of rejecting or deflating metaphysics in the positivist fashion that appealed to Nietzsche for a brief period, eternal recurrence embraces metaphysics. It is itself a piece of metaphysics, but it's metaphysics turned inside out. So what it does is identify, as that earlier passage indicated, it just identifies the flux of becoming with the fixity of being. It identifies appearance with reality, time with eternity, contingency with necessity, finitude with infinitude, and so on. Now, there is no argument for this. There's no metaphysical argument for this. Nietzsche is not Hegel. He's not trying to show us that these things are really the same. The identification is simply asserted, and that's why I refer to it as an incongruous superimposition. So the assertion is an act of force, and Nietzsche sometimes describes the doctrine, in inverted commas, as a deed, something that Zarathustra does. Well, what's the point of it? What's the point of this forceful deed? Well, as I understand it, when Nietzsche's demon or Zarathustra tells us of eternal recurrence, he is saying, as it were, to himself as much as to us, the fact is that our deepest need is metaphysical. We have a need for eternity. And we shouldn't pretend otherwise. We shouldn't pretend that we can free ourselves of it. Nietzsche supposed at one point that we could, but abandon that notion. What we also know is that this need can't be fulfilled in the way that earlier ages tried to fulfill it. And we also know that presently it is a source of sickness. It is corrosive. The metaphysical need is something that we suffer from. So what we can do, and the only thing we can do, is try to invent a fiction which would fulfill our metaphysical need. And Nietzsche's suggestion for this fiction is eternal recurrence. Eternal recurrence strikes us initially as the worst of all possible worlds. It's the Groundhog Day, the greatest weight. But since there is no alternative to it, given our metaphysical needs, given our knowledge, our modern knowledge of reality, what it thereby does is show us, in the form of a fiction, what it is that we must learn to love. So we are compelled to choose to affirm the eternal recurrence as it were, the best of all possible worlds. So, what I've just said about eternal recurrence will perhaps give some idea of how I think the other question which I raised, namely the question of what Nietzsche in general is up to, what is his philosophical practice about, should be answered. And if I put this fairly briefly, what Nietzsche is, on my account, offering is a kind of ideational image. And the point of it is to serve as a lens that will modify what he calls our optical habits. These optical habits are more deeply entrenched in us than our beliefs. Beliefs come and go. Christianity gives way to modern science. But our optical habits remain unchanged. And Nietzsche thinks that this is all actually that philosophy can do. Concepts in general, for him, are just ways of picturing. And the most that a philosophical concept or system of concepts can do is rather like a revolution in the arts, art or cubism or whatever, it can introduce a new way of picturing. Now, at this point, it might be asked or objected, well, okay, I'll grant all of this, but how exactly can I use an idea that, I've argued, doesn't add up conceptually as an image? And my answer to this is that, well, the image can be formed. Here, comparison is with this famous Escher drawing. We can form the image of eternal recurrence. What is incoherent is not the image, but what the image represents. So we can see the drawing, even if we can't coherently conceive the architecture depicted by it. Worth noting that, in their own way, Escher's drawings are instances of eternal recurrence. The route they have as follow is, the figure follows, is circular, leads back to the beginning, goes round and round and round and round, round again. Now, the difference of eternal recurrence from the Escher drawing is that, as Nietzsche intends it, we're not supposed to simply contemplate the idea of eternal recurrence, that is, we're not just to read the passage in Gay Science again and again. That would give us only a kind of literary or semi-pictorial experience. What Nietzsche wants us to do is to incorporate or internalize the idea. So, in terms of this analogy, we're not just to look at the drawing. We're also supposed to seek to assume the shape of the architecture represented in the drawing. To which may, of course, be objected again that, well, this is impossible. The Escher building can't exist, so nor can we will the eternal recurrence of our lives. And this would be a fatal objection if eternal recurrence were a doctrine pretending to truth, or if it were possible only to will ends that we know we can achieve. But I've explained that, at least on my account, eternal recurrence makes no claim to truth at all. And now to the second point, Nietzsche's view, and actually also that of many others in the history of philosophy, is that it is just false that we can only will what we believe we are able to achieve. What we can realize. In fact, if Nietzsche is right, aiming at the impossible, either knowingly or unwittingly, has been a distinguishing trait of human beings for the last 2.5 millennia. That's what makes us special kinds of animals. And that being our condition, the real question is which impossibility to aim at, and Nietzsche's recommendation is for eternal recurrence. I have just 2 minutes more. 1 minute. So, in the very little time that remains, just very, very quickly, I want to summarize, as I understand it, the distance between Nietzsche's eternal recurrence and psychoanalytic ideas about repetition and such like, and then say very quickly how they nonetheless come together. So, I hope this, what I said, it explains to some degree, my opaque title. Eternal recurrence in Nietzsche is a conceptual figure, that is, it's an idea employed as an image. It's not strictly a metaphor, because metaphor would imply contrast with something non-metaphorical, like literal. And Nietzsche doesn't think that there is any such thing as a literal metaphysical judgment. So it is a conceptual figure in the sense that it uses concepts to work upon us, like images, changing and modifying our optical habits. Freud's concerns are instead with configurations of the unconscious, orderings of the unconscious, of unconscious content, which are responsible for those deep but hard to discern patterns that we find manifest in the way we live our lives. So, two differences of Nietzsche from Freud are, therefore, that first, Nietzsche's recurrence is fictional, whereas the unconscious configurations that Freud is concerned with are not fictional, but actual. And secondly, that Nietzsche's eternal recurrence is total, in the sense that it is the recurrence of a whole life, not the recurrence, as we have with Freud, of anything within a life. The eternal recurrence of a life as a whole isn't the repetition of a particular pattern within it. So those are, see the deep differences. The deep connection between the two ideas consists in the fact that in both cases, the eye of reflection is making contact with something that it recognizes as in some sense, transcending its own boundaries. My other lives, these other versions of my life, are ones that I can't touch. They're not here, now, with me. They're over there. Just as the unconscious configurations that psychoanalysis reveals can't be brought to mind in the same way as I bring to mind my perceptual states and ordinary thoughts. So the eye of reflection of self-consciousness is making contact with something that transcends it, yet which it must also recognize as comprising more of itself, as expressing its own will, as describable as its own self-determined fate. So for Nietzsche, eternal recurrence is not itself a problem, rather it's the answer to all problems. In fact, it's the condition for my existing at all. The problem posed by eternal recurrence concerns just my capacity to assent to it, or to will it, to want it. For Freud, by contrast, confrontation with unconscious configurations does pose a problem. And it requires some kind of resolution, some kind of reconfiguration. So to bring these ideas together, what I see is the point of contact between them. Taking control of or redetermining unconscious configurations, those uncovered in self-analysis, this is a condition, undoubtedly a necessary but probably not a sufficient condition for the love of fate, or the ascent to eternal recurrence, recommended by Nietzsche. Okay. Thank you.
Okay, I think we've got 5 minutes for questions, if that's okay. Does anybody... can I just say one thing? My father was a kind of philosopher taxi driver.
I'm sorry.
My father was a kind of philosopher taxi driver. And he called himself a born-again atheist. And he based that on Nietzsche's metaphysics. And I've only understood now. So I'm very, very for that.
Well, we spent all our lives trying to catch up with our fathers. So.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Sebastian. I just wanted to press a little bit on what you said towards the end there about the idea of Nietzsche aiming for the impossible, and in relation to Nietzsche's own conception of the aesthetic ideal. Obviously, the Platonists or the Christian, in their own way, believe in this sort of otherworldly or dualistic conception. But I just wanted to know what you thought about that in relation to Nietzsche's eternal recurrence.
Okay. Well, I didn't make reference to the aesthetic ideal Beswick, you know, might have done or should have done in the list of impossibilities that humankind has been aiming at. So the aesthetic ideal, as I understand it, it is an absolute valorization of the virtue, the value of truthfulness. And the point of it is not, it isn't truthfulness for its own sake, obviously. That's the form that it takes, or the way we think about it. So we think the natural scientist, the philosopher, the theoretician is under an obligation to say what they believe to be true just because it's true. So that's how we express it. But Nietzsche doesn't, he thinks, he doesn't accept the aesthetic ideal at face value. So the genealogy of morals, the third essay, the argument there, and its commentators generally agree, is that we're hankering, we continue to hanker after something. We want to be truthful, to have the truth, for the sake of, and then what follows, what fills the ellipses, is not quite so clear, but it doesn't matter, I think, terribly for our understanding of Nietzsche. What he does think is that that for the sake of which we strive to be truthful is platonic or metaphysical. And on that account, it is an impossibility. So the realization of the aesthetic ideal is, as we desire it, it is a fantasy of the sort, is impossible. What historically happens is that pursuit of the aesthetic ideal leads us, as the aesthetic ideal discloses to us the impossibility of its own fulfillment. So as we, seeking truth, find out the truth about the aesthetic ideal, which is what Nietzsche is telling us, at that point, everything implodes. And that is the catastrophe of nihilism in its modern form. That is why nihilism is precipitated out by natural science. So, Nietzsche has, again, of course, commentators on Nietzsche disagree hugely about this, about what he thinks about science, but on the narrative that I'm proposing, Nietzsche has no theoretical argument with that. He's not saying it's wrong for theoretical reasons to believe in science to that extent. He's not saying the value of truthfulness is overrated, there are more important things in life. What he's just doing is showing us what happens if the aesthetic ideal is allowed to run its course to its natural conclusion. And that conclusion is disastrous. And the recognition of that disaster, we recoil from it, we acknowledge our metaphysical needs, natural science will never satisfy us, and then we change direction. And as you know, at different points in Nietzsche's work, he changes, he explores different avenues. And in the Birth of Tragedy, art is offered. In the mid-period work, he seems to think that natural science, if done in a different way, a new way, that would do the trick. And then in what I guess we refer to as his mature writing, which comes from, the concepts of will to power and paired up with eternal recurrence become the alternative. So the aesthetic ideal is the diagnosis of the real will that lies behind our modern naturalism and commitment to truth, and recognizing that motivator and the impossibility of fulfilling it. That is sufficient to, this is the strategy, but at any rate, to make us will something different, which we can do with a good conscience because, well, this is not something I've talked about, Nietzsche doesn't think that true truth or real truth is really possible at all. So even our best scientific theory of the world wouldn't tick the box for Nietzsche as regards getting hold of being as it is in itself. And that's what entitles us to switch out, switch away from science to fictions or myths or pictorial images. Sorry, does that answer the question?
I'm afraid we're going to have to come to close at that point, but thank you so much, that was really illuminating. I'm sure that's what it's about.